school districts and non-district charter schools. State said that the Infinite Campus had the highest scoring proposal based on several criteria, including having the highest technical score and the lowest cost. This is WPR News.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you along today. In addition to telling you about a whole host of things coming in the arts, culture, and humanities of Western Wisconsin, we'll be spending time with Eau Claire Poet Laureate Bruce Taylor today and getting a little poetic injection for Valentine's Day. Jim Oliver talks with retired professor and author Ken Perico about his newest book and historical novel about Pliny the Elder. And if that sounds Greek to you or Roman, you will be a bit more familiar with him a bit later on. Bruce White has written about the Ojibwe and Dakota tribes and will be making an interesting presentation next Saturday at the St. Croix River Visitor Center as part of the 2013 Riverway Speaker Series. He'll be here. And we begin with some dialogue with Gordon Murphy in his first season as executive director of the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. The challenges have proven to be many but manageable, especially for someone with a varied background, musician within the symphony, IT experience, and an ability in and a love for interaction that makes him the perfect PR pupil. He will oversee the middle child of a 5-concert season tomorrow evening as the symphony welcomes back Nachito Herrera, returning to wow another audience with his pianistic proficiency and power, this time within his interpretation of several things, Gershwin. What was that name again? Nachito Herrera. He showed up last year, and I guess he knocked people's socks off.
Yes, he did. He's a powerful pianist. He's in the past broken strings while he plays the piano.
Oh, my.
It has to be a very strong piano. We're bringing in the largest Yamaha and a 9-foot, 9-inch grand. He knows how to leverage his body, and when he plays the piano, it's just electrifying.
Is this a different kind of concert than he did last year? Because this is Gershwin, and can you go nuts with Gershwin?
You've got a good point there. The Rhapsody in Blue is what put George Gershwin on the legitimate part of the map. And before then, he was a songwriter. People thought he was great in that venue, but they didn't give him any credit with a serious venue. But that put him on the map as being an official, legitimate composer.
And it's one of those songs where people would maybe not recognize it by title, but as soon as they heard it.
Without a doubt. It is, I have been reaching out with just about anybody I can think of, say, you've heard this music, you love this music, it's great music, it's going to be a great concert.
Yeah. And you know what? We don't use the word rhapsody as much as we should anymore.
Oh, that is a good word.
You've been experimenting with different places that you are playing. Tell us about the concert that you had in Chippewa Falls. How'd that go?
I think it went very, very well. People walked out of that place very happy. It was a great holiday concert. Across the hall, there was a basketball game going on. It all worked out great. We succeeded in showing our appreciation to Chippewa Falls. You know, our name is Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra.
You bet.
And so Chippewa Valley is large. And so we wanted to reach out and make sure they knew we were a part of this whole area. The Chippewa Falls choir and being in that venue was very good, very successful, and we appreciate having the chance to play there.
Gordon Murphy, Executive Director, Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra, with us on Spectrum West. And this is your first season as director.
Yes, it is.
Tell me about the pleasant surprises you've had as director.
Well, the pleasant surprises are actually every day, almost every hour. Someone calls up, wants to have tickets. They want to find out how to become more involved. Getting to know the community at large has been a fantastic bonus. And even though I've lived here for nearly 25 years, it's just amazing how this position has helped me meet more people and be out and about in the community more. So in that sense, it's been very rewarding.
Your professional background is kind of an IT technological thing. Are you applying that to
how and where the symphony exposes itself?
I sure am. And we have another person in the office, Jennifer Newman, and I are both, I consider ourselves to be very computer literate. Jen is working hard getting the Facebook part of and the social media part of mm-hmm. the orchestra further developed. I'm concentrating on the more backbone part of it.
And the intent of the application of all this wonderful technology is to continue to bring the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra more to the center of that mainstream that's out there, because that's a discussion that the symphony has on a regular basis, is how do we get people to recognize and appreciate, because we know that if they were just simply exposed to the symphony, they would appreciate what it is, what it's for, and want to come back, connecting with new people.
Exactly. And that is one of our primary missions, to expose a person who's never been to a symphony concert ever before. Mm-hmm. We'd love to just have them come out and hear it. These days, due to the amazing amount of music scores in films, mm-hmm. people are actually exposed to a lot of music we know very well. Our first concert of the season, Mahler's Sixth,
yes.
Was a wonderful concert. There's been many films that have lifted melodies off of that symphony, so people have been exposed to her music, and especially the one that's coming up this Saturday night is probably something that people would be shocked at how much they've heard.
Fundraising, obviously more important than ever, simply because of cutbacks in certain areas. For those listening who say, you know what, the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra is one of those things that I want to see perpetuated, and I want to become somehow involved, how do they do that?
So if you come to our concerts, that's a wonderful way to start.
Good.
And then if you even donate at a small level, we appreciate it. And then we have a friends organization, which is in the process of building. We had a wonderful Christmas stroll. And we mm-hmm. will be having a garden stroll. All those activities are sponsored by the Friends of the Symphony.
Okay.
That's a great way to give time and energy and thought. So donors, Friends of the Symphony, and being a part of the board.
And someone out there listening who has not been exposed to it, just a phone call to the symphony office with any questions they might have is a great way to start the ball rolling.
You bet.
You have another concert coming up in March. Tell us about that.
That's our Young Artist Competition. It's our Young Artist Concert sponsored by Christo Orthodontics.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very fortunate to have Christo sponsor that concert. Every year we sponsor a competition, and the winner of that competition plays. We go out and reach out to the public schools
mm-hmm.
All throughout. And we attempt to get into as many schools as we can, and musicians will play in front of typically third and fourth graders. When a student comes into the classroom and listens to the musician out in the schools,
sure.
they get a coupon for two tickets.
Neat.
You know, sometimes people call up and say, well, that's just a young person's concert. And I say, no, it's great music. It's great performers. You might see more young people in the audience than mm-hmm. you usually do. But it is great for all ages. And I just want to say one more thing. Actually, every concert is a good time to bring young people. You have mm-hmm. to be respectful. But I brought my baby to the concerts when she was 3 months old.
Wow.
There were only a few times I needed to take her out to the lobby, but the lobby is big. So I encourage all ages to come.
Well, and it's also nice to hang out with what will prove to be the future of music in our valley.
Without a doubt.
Well, congratulations on pulling off a very successful season thus far in your rookie year as executive director, and keep up the good work.
Hey, thank you very much.
Gordon Murphy. Again, it's tomorrow evening at the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center, the State Theater, 7:30. Pianist Nachito Herrera is back, and featured will be Gershwin's Cuban Overture, An American in Paris, and of course, as we mentioned, Rhapsody in Blue. A memorable evening. Tickets at cvsymphony.org and by phone at 715-832-6366.
Here's what's on stage this weekend and beyond at Western Wisconsin theater venues. A dinner theater production of Bingo the Musical plays tonight and Sunday, and next Thursday, Friday, and Sunday at the Northern Star Theater in Rice Lake. There are no Saturday performances. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of They're Playing Our Song plays tonight, Saturday and Sunday, at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The Chippewa Falls Public Library and the Chippewa Valley Cultural Association will present a one-person interactive show, Shakespeare, Here and Now, Thursday at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Phipps Children's Theater will present the Disney musical Little Mermaid Jr. tonight, Saturday and Sunday, and next Friday, Saturday and Sunday, at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The show runs weekends through February 24th. Stone Soup, a production aimed at students in pre-kindergarten through third grade, will play weekdays through February 22nd at the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. And Elvis, The Essence of the King, plays tonight, Saturday and Sunday, and selected weekdays at the Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through March the 3rd. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Some moving music there for you. 17 after 5 o'clock on Spectrum West. Spectrum Memos, the 5th annual 24-hour project, a show written, rehearsed, and performed within 24 hours, will culminate with a performance open to the public at 7 p.m. tomorrow in the Riverside Theater, the Haas Fine Arts Center, at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Hosted by the UWEC Players, student artists from multiple disciplines collaborate to produce a show that incorporates one theme and one location. Tickets available at the door, and they're $4 for general admission, $3 with a non-perishable food item donation. More Spectrum Memos in a moment, but I want to remind you that support for WPR and Spectrum West comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, dedicated to providing exceptional service and now transferring direct deposits and automatic payments when signing up for new checking accounts. More information at wisconsincu.org. Well, you've been instrumental.
Support also comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, dedicated to providing exceptional service and now transferring direct deposits and automatic payments when signing up for new checking accounts. More information at wisconsincu.org.
Yes, sir. All you have to do is hit the right button. You see, and when you do that, everything comes out okay. Here's some more Spectrum Memoranda for you. Tomorrow evening at the Heide Center, it's a big band jazz jam put on by the Chippewa Falls High School Jazz Department, a fundraiser for the Music Association. And Sunday afternoon, the 4th annual Hearts in Harmony show, featuring barbershop quartets from throughout the valley. In the Heide Center Gallery, an exhibit titled Bloom, showcasing the work of artists Terry Meyer and Jason Stabenow. Heide info is at 726-9000. That's the phone number, and at cvca.net. In the Janet Carson Gallery at the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center, see the work of Hyun Sang Yu and Kendall McMinimy. That's on now through March 1st. Info about all events is at eauclairearts.com. Well, you know, it's always fun and enlightening whenever we can convince a poet laureate to stop by for a visit. We've had the privilege of welcoming several over the years here. This week we greeted the Eau Claire variety, Bruce Taylor, for a couple poems in salute of Valentine's Day and a look at events, poetic, coming up in our valleys of western Wisconsin. Well, you've been instrumental in bringing poetry more to the masses than people have been exposed in the past, but I know that that is one of the responsibilities, if there is such, of a poet laureate. How do you view that responsibility? Have you found that to be the rewarding side of it?
Yeah, sure. There's a number of rewarding sides. So one is you get to make a lot of jokes about being the poet laureate. And I really didn't have, you know, I didn't think I would need to do anything, because the official charge is you have to write 2 poems a year having to do something with Eau Claire and deliver them, my favorite line, for publication. But then when I started to think about it, I know that we used to have a pretty vibrant reading scene here. There was the NOTA, the None of the Above, at the university, still has, I think, the longest open-running reading series in the country. Hmm. It was a community college thing, and there used to be much more community involved. And then I knew that, you know, there used to be that wonderful poetry slam that they had down at the Acoustic. a bunch of my former students actually had started it, and it was hugely popular, particularly among like high school
kids. Going on anymore?
No, and one of the reasons is understandable. My students got older, and they got married, and they got jobs, and they got kids, and time becomes a premium.
Well, you hand it down, though, don't you?
They tried, but it just didn't, you know, it sort of petered out after a while.
Okay. I know they still have them up in Rice Lake at UWBC.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we have not just slams per se, but we have the open mic now at the Acoustic back again. First Wednesday of every month, 7 o'clock.
So have you, and do you have any, do you have leeway to add innovations to the post?
Oh, sure. You can. I don't, you know, I think it's way open for whatever kind of input. In a way, it's sort of the National Poet Laureate. The tradition there is that when a new poet laureate is appointed, they come up with sort of a project. Mm. You know, it's a little like Miss America, you know, when you are the first lady, you know, when you have I'm going to do gardening or something.
Oh, okay.
I had a bunch of different ideas, and the ones that seem to come to fruition so far, anyway, most readily were the readings, and that's the open reading I just talked about. Mm-hmm. And then we do the third Thursday at the gallery at the Regional Arts Center. Mm-hmm. At the Janet Carson Gallery at 5 o'clock. We have one poet there. It's usually a quick hitter, maybe 40 minutes or so, 45 minutes or so. That's the third Thursday. And then the second Tuesday of each month, we have a reading at the Ellie Phillips Library. Yep. Mm-hmm. And those are themed readings or feature readings, one writer, two writers. We did one back a little while ago called Funny Stuff, where we had Larry Heagle, and we had John Loomis, and we had Augie Rubric. That was a really good night. Last month we did for January, Beginnings and Endings was the theme. Uh-huh. We had in December, Max came in and brought students from his creative writing class. Mm-hmm. The theme was Let It Snow. We had no snow at all up until the day before that. So I think it worked out.
So you bring some cosmic stuff with you. That's interesting.
Well, poetry. You know,
you were convinced to become Poet Laureate by a cosmic occasion, and here we go. You know, and one of the events that you were speaking of is coming up Tuesday, and I love the theme of it, Love and Other Disasters, a real tongue-in-cheek thing. That reminds me, I had a biology teacher when I was in high school. He always used to remind us that the female of the species is more deadly than the male.
And then you found out.
Yes. it's fun to poke fun at love and romance.
You have to. You absolutely have to. You know, I taught for about 30 years or more at the university an honors course called Love in the Western World. And there's a whole explanation for that I won't get into. It was poems and stories and films and philosophy and art and, you know, all having to do with love. And, of course, one of the things that you realize when you're talking about love and passion and romance is you're always one whisker away from a disaster or comedy or humor. You know, you go in, you drop the special gal off at night, you know, on her front porch, and you move in a little bit to get that first kiss, and you misjudge just a little bit and stick your nose right in her eye.
Yeah.
It's a whole different thing then. You know?
That's probably the angle of love that is the most humorous, is that we try too hard.
Yes, absolutely. That, and the first thing I always said in that course was most people believe everyone has always loved in exactly the same way we do, every time, every place, or people believe no one has, you know?
Oh, sure.
And so you work in the middle ground there.
Bruce Taylor, Eau Claire, Poet Laureate, and he's here to talk about an event we have coming up on Tuesday at the Ellie Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire, Love and Other Disasters. Hopefully you've brought some verse to get our hearts throbbing for the day. Now, your event is 2 days prior to Valentine's Day, so you'll give people some impetus
sort of
to go
warm
out.
Sort of a warm-up.
That's a good one.
And also, you know, I'll just mention that in each one of these themed events, we feature a few poets, a few writers. And so we have Max Garland is going to be reading, and Ken Sismansky, Karen Loeb, Patty C., and Aaron Wadooley. Those will be our featured writers for the Love and Other Disasters.
That's a whole roster.
It's a pretty good lineup. Yeah, indeed.
So read me something. Do you have something that's dripping with syrup? And
well, I have actually...
Or saccharin?
A number of things, because I didn't know what kind of things we're going to be reading. And they sort of touch on various aspects of this.
That's good. So I trust you. You're the poet laureate. I have to trust you.
You have to. There's no other choice.
Mm-hmm.
This poem would be the gooby gooby sweetie sweetie stuff, and this was I love this poem because it was one of those given poems to me. I was sitting in a library, a middle school library, one day. I was doing a poet in schools thing. I turned around and saw these two kids in the stacks. And so this is called Love Poem.
Okay.
In the middle school library, here's love, but not a lot. Between almanac and dictionary, they check each other out. They show a great reserve of curiosity arousing, and neither stray nor swerve among the stacks they're browsing. Behind the oversized books, they seek some definitions and lend each other classic looks amongst the first editions. Through hush of dust and mildew, their passage newly overdue.
Oh.
A sonnet, of course.
Yes, oh, certainly.
Gotta be.
Sonnets. Are sonnets a thing of the past?
Mm-mm.
Oh, really? Are people still writing sonnets to each
absolutely.
Other?
Absolutely. Well, I don't, to each other, I don't know. I hope they are, and I hope they, most people shouldn't show them to anyone but the other.
That's true.
They're very hard to do. You know? Right. But the sonnet in one form is the perfect form for a love poem, because it's such a thinky and contradictory form.
What is a sonnet as a form?
Well, it's, you know, there are many different kinds and many definitions, but I think the important part of most every sonnet, certainly the ones we're most familiar with in English, which would be the Shakespearean and the Petrarchan sonnet, is that there's three moves, three basic moves in it. There's one that says this, and then another one that could say and this or but this, you know, except this, and then the third one is therefore this.
Ah, okay.
You know, so it's sort of like a, you know, it's a thesis, antithesis, synthesis kind of thing. Boom, boom, boom.
Wow.
And, of course, the sonnet can be certainly witty and ironic, and that fits into love very, very well, too. Yeah, the sonnet in love, as far as poems in love poems go, that's pretty much number one, I think.
Mm-hmm. So sonnets are hard to write.
Oh, yeah.
Are they easy to read?
If it's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And one of the reasons they're hard to write is because, as with so many forms, traditional forms, I do about half of what I do in traditional forms. In English, it comes from another language. Mm. You know, so the sonnet comes primarily, particularly Petrarchan, comes from Italian. It's easy to rhyme in Italian. Everything ends in a vowel. You know, it's an A, it's an O, it's, you know, you can barely miss. Pretty much the same thing in all the Romance languages, French and Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
In English, it's much more difficult to rhyme. So, you know, we've sort of imported it from another country and culture and then tried to make it our own.
Okay, give us one more Valentine's type genre poem, and then we'll give people an idea of what else is coming up in your series.
This one is maybe the opposite of that last one, which is sort of the young love and the saccharine and the, you know. This would be a love poem from a longer-term relationship, say, maybe even a married love poem. It's called This Is Just to Say, and that title I've stolen directly from the famous William Carlos Williams poem. This is just to say I've eaten the plums that you left in the icebox. Excuse me, they are so delicious and cool. And he always said that was a real note that he had left for his wife. I did something at the Book Fest in Madison on found poems, you know, poems that are just there. You just pick them up and say it's a poem and it becomes a poem. So this is called This Is Just to Say, and it's two real notes that went on between my wife and I.
Okay, good.
One in the morning, one in the evening. This is just to say, when I saw all those green beans strings in a Cool Whip container on our sunny kitchen counter, not even a bit of bean left, not even on one string, I knew, you know, how much I love green beans, but that I am too lazy to make them for myself. 2. When I saw your note about green beans this gray evening in our empty kitchen, I laughed. There was not even one bit of bean because it was a pile of spinach stalks, which, as you know, I hate. I love you so much back.
Yeah, love, married love is a different form than middle school love, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, that's one of the things we're pumped so full of certain kinds of messages and ideas and ideals and expectations about love. I mean, you know, the music, 98% of all songs are still love songs. Our stories, our movies, whatever, and it all has a certain message.
Yeah.
About love and what love should be and how you should react. So then when you run into the real thing, you know, it's sometimes difficult to sort of adjust. I know my students always thought that what that meant was, you know, you had this great, wonderful, passionate love, and then as you get older or you get married or, you know, you had this other thing you had to settle for.
Mm.
And that's, of course, not true at all.
Well, today we're bombarded with a lot more lust than we used to be.
Yes, it's a very fine line.
Yeah. So you have an event coming up Tuesday, Love and Other Disasters.
Indeed.
And you mentioned the guests already. What else is coming up in your series?
In the library series, we have a couple of really interesting things. I think in March, this is the always the second Tuesday.
Okay.
In March at the library, we're having my friend Frank Smoot, who is the indomitable columnist from Volume 1. Mm-hmm. He has a column called Thanks for Asking.
Historian by
yes,
nature, yes.
Yes, where he talks about Eau Claire and little-known things, and people mm-hmm. ask questions about Eau Claire. Well, I managed to get him to come in to do a thing at the library in March on the second Tuesday called Frank's for Asking. And he's going to be talking about the column and things that he may have got wrong that he'd like to correct, questions he wished that he had been asked, mm-hmm. questions that he might ask if he were on the other side of it. And, you know, anyone who knows Frank knows he's a very smart, intelligent, entertaining, charming man. And so we're looking very much forward to that. In April at the library, second Tuesday, we have one called The Long Goodbye. And that will be Patty C. reading from, she has an award-winning blog called The Long Goodbye. You know, she has readers in Vietnam, in Ghana, in Oman. You know? And so this Long Goodbye is a story about how her family dealt with their mother's Alzheimer's and the 7 or 8 years that it took. Lovely, touching, beautiful thing. At the gallery, third Thursday at the gallery this month is going to be Sarah Bryan. Next month, Jeannie Robinson from her new book, The Nature of It All. Mm-hmm. Then in some order, I've forgotten, we'd have Allison Loomis, and we're going to have, you know, a lot of good people there. And then the first Wednesday, the open, anybody. As long as it's original words, poems, stories, prose, stand-up, singer-songwriters, you know, mm-hmm. come on down and talk to us.
Bruce Taylor, thanks for joining us. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for asking me.
A little My Funny Valentine in the background. Love and Other Disasters, Tuesday, 7 p.m. in the Eau Claire Room of the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library. Other things happening on Valentine's Day, the Wyman Series at UW River Falls presents Carnival Brasileiro, Brazilian Carnival, at 7:30 p.m. Thursday at the Falcon's Nest at the University Center. It's free, and it's open to all of us. The Menominee Art Music Society presents a Valentine's Day program of love songs and music by classical composers. That is next Sunday, 3 p.m. at United Methodist Church. No, that's this Sunday. Day after tomorrow, 3 p.m., United Methodist Church in Menominee. Mary Mack's My Funny Valentine show comes to the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond next Saturday, the 16th, 8 p.m. Tickets at 715-246-3285. Mary's website is marymackcomedy.com. The Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls hosts the 4th annual Hopelessly Romantic Valentine's event, 7:30 p.m. Thursday, Valentine's Day, featuring music, improv, comedy, and other festival favorites, like a poetry contest. It's recommended that you secure reservations by Monday, the day after, I mean, this coming Monday. Sunday the 17th, Girl Singers of the Hit Parade, 2:30 p.m. at the Festival Theater. Their website is Festival Theater, that's theatre.org. Spectrum West at 5:34. I'm Al Ross. Thanks so much for being with us today. We appreciate your attendance. Time for Jim Oliver to give us something from the literary / historic world on today's Oliver Occasion. Jim, it's all yours. Take it away.
Across the waters of time, Pliny Remembered is the story of the first century Roman author and naturalist Pliny the Elder. Lesser known than other ancient historical figures like Cleopatra and Julius Caesar, Pliny the Elder lived at the center of pivotal events of the first century. He was one of the first to remind people that we must care for the earth. The author of Across the Waters of Time is Ken Perico, a retired professor of biology at UW Stout who lives in Holcomb. He joins us to talk about Pliny the Elder and perhaps about his other books. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, you have an undergraduate degree in molecular biology and graduate degrees in biochemistry and aquatic ecology. So tell us how you got interested in the history of Pliny the Elder.
Well, that's a good question. It actually goes back almost 4 decades. When I first heard about Pliny, the story was that he would be riding on his horse and his secretary would be riding alongside him. And sometimes this would happen in a snowstorm in northern Germany. And Pliny was had such a volcanic mind, so eruptive and so full and always creative, always commenting on what he saw. He would be dictating to his secretary who was writing next to him and having to write down all these things that Pliny was saying. And I thought, good gosh, who is this guy who knows so much and wants to tell people so much, a type A personality? It came time to write another novel. I realized, this is a person who is interesting and deserves exploring. And then, of course, as I got into the history of his life and his work, as author of A Natural History, which was the first real encyclopedia in the Western tradition, I discovered what a great sort of scientist he was, observing the world, but also what an interesting environmentalist he was. And he isn't known as well as he should be for his environmental ethics. And so I sort of wanted to be a bully pulpit for the life of Pliny the Elder for many reasons.
There's obviously a tremendous amount of research that went into this book. You told me how long it has taken you from start to finish.
About a dozen years.
About a dozen years.
From when I started, it's when it finally saw the light of day.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about what went into the research. Did you travel around a bit or what?
It involved a lot of reading. There isn't much written about Pliny's life. His nephew, who he adopted and became his adopted son, Pliny the Younger, tells us a little bit about Pliny's life in his letters and other comments that Pliny the Younger made. So there's a little bit written by other contemporaries of Pliny the Elder, but there's a lot of conjecture. The only biography that has been written about him was written in 1979 at the 1900th anniversary of Pliny's death. And that biography is only about 50 pages long. It's written in German. I did read it. There's not much in it that you can get. There's a lot of filling here and there. So what I started to do was not just research Pliny's life, but his times and what Roman life was like in the first century of our era. And, of course, that's a big project. So it involved an awful lot of reading on a lot of different topics. In order to familiarize myself with what it would have been like to be a Roman living in the year 50. I probably read 100 books and took notes from them in addition to journal articles. And then I did travel to Italy to actually walk the beach that Pliny walked, that he died on in Stabia across the Bay of Naples from Misenum, where he was living when he died. And I was fortunate enough to make contact with someone from the Misenum Historical Association who took me into places ordinary tourists don't go so that I could get a good sense of what it was like to have lived there. And so it was a combination of an awful lot of reading. I feel you have to sort of ground yourself. What did Pliny see when he went out for a walk in the evening? What was it like to take the boats across the Bay of Naples towards Pompeii and Herculaneum during Vesuvius's eruption? And so it's research not only of an intellectual kind, but there's a kind of emotional research that takes place at that point.
Now, did he die as a result of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius?
He did die, yes. He died as a result of the eruption, and that's a very fascinating story of its own. He was taking a nap on the afternoon of August 24th of the year 79, and his sister, who was living with him, came and woke him up from his nap and said, "Pliny, Vesuvius is erupting. Come, you must see." He looked at it, and he realized, this is a fascinating thing. It's a volcanic eruption that I can study. He was the admiral of the Roman fleet at that time. He went down to get on his ship. When he got a note from a friend who lived in Herculaneum saying, "You must rescue us. The volcano is erupting, and we're in great danger here." So then at that point, he took his entire fleet towards the eruption. I see that as very analogous to the fireman going up the stairs in the World Trade Center towards danger as other people were running away from it. He was taking his men towards it. And so what started as a journey of scientific observation became a journey to attempt to rescue his friends and as many people as he could.
He is Ken Perico, author of Across the Waters of Time, Pliny Remembered. Well, how influential was he in his time? He traveled all over creation. He wasn't just in Italy.
And that's the other fascinating thing about him. He passed on to us one of the great treasures of the ages, which is his natural history, which in the version I have is about 3,000 pages of an encyclopedia. But if you look beyond that, he had a very fascinating life. He traveled to Germany as a cavalry officer to northern Germany on the Rhine. and he traveled to Belgium, he traveled to Spain, he went to Judea, he went to North Africa, he went to Syria. He worked his way up what was known at that time as the cursus honorum. It's the way you move up in power in the political realm of Rome. He was well known, very highly respected. He had written what his nephew claims is about 100 books. They've all been lost except for the natural history. Pliny had kept a journal most of his life, and I would just love to get my hands on a copy of that journal.
On the back cover of the book, it talks about he was alive for the birth of one religion and one destroyed. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, having been born in the year 22, he was alive, a contemporary of Christ. He was in Judea for the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 67, when he was an aide to Titus and working with Titus's father, Vespasian, basically to destroy the Jewish religion, if they could. The complex politics in the Middle East were troubling the Romans as they trouble us. And there was, of course, the Jewish people who would not accept Roman power over them. So the Romans responded by destroying the Second Temple. But, of course, at that time, Christianity was on its rise. In my book, I have his secretary actually become Christian. And we don't know if that was true or not, but they were traveling in the kinds of circles where Christianity intersected with the pagan Roman beliefs. He was a witness to the attempt to destroy the Jewish people, and the Romans thought probably they had. Well, of course, they didn't. The Jews outlasted the Romans. And he was in the very area of Galilee, the Dead Sea, when the early Christians were there.
Now, the book is written as fiction, and it's written in first person with Pliny doing the talking. Why did you choose that format?
I'm a big fan of historical movies, historical novels, and I think it's important to bring history to life, not to experience history as dry words on a page. And I think by fictionalizing it, we can make people experience it in a way that they don't experience it by reading just ordinary fiction. And, we say that fiction can be truer than truth. I'd originally written the book in the third person. He did this and he did that. A number of people I gave it to read said it's good, but it's not really compelling. It doesn't grab me. Well, maybe I should rewrite it in first person. And I think it makes it more intimate and more compelling.
I noticed that among your hobbies are gardening, growing hops, and brewing beer. Now, I was able to learn that there is a beer brewed in California called Pliny the Elder Beer, and I was able to find a recipe for the beer as well. By any chance, is the beer that you brew at home related to one of the Pliny beers?
Thanks for asking that. Yeah, actually, I did find a recipe for Pliny the Elder, which is brewed by the Russian River Brewing Company in Santa Rosa, California. Voted by the American Homebrewers Association as the best American beer, period. I did find a recipe for it, and I have brewed as close a copy of the Russian River Pliny the Elder as I can. You can't buy it here. They sell it in California. My son, also a beer connoisseur, had Pliny the Elder, and he says it's as good as they say it is.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk a little bit about your other books. Your 2010 book, Monarch of the Butterflies, came out of your college biology courses. Tell us how that happened.
Yeah, well, when I was teaching biology and ecology at Stout, I would collect a monarch butterfly eggs during the summer, which are found on the bottom of the leaves of the milkweed plant, and then they would hatch into the really tiny caterpillars. I would take them into my classes, and each group of four students would get one of these little monarch caterpillars, or larvae, as we call them. And there was your job to make sure it got fed, take care of it, weigh it as it was growing up. We would sometimes have them grow up at different temperatures to see how temperature affected their growth rate. Those that survived, and it would be most of them, would then turn into a chrysalis, which is like a cocoon. And after about a week in the chrysalis, of course, they emerge from that into a butterfly, which is a fascinating thing to watch. And this would provide the students the opportunity to watch that process. We would take them outside as a class, and we would release them into the sky. It was their first flight. And it was a very emotional, touching thing to do, to watch this little butterfly take off Usually they would land in a little bit of time. They would land and catch their bearings, and I think they were probably as astonished as we were that they could actually fly. And then they would head off to Mexico because we did this in the fall. That's where they go. Those butterflies had never been to Mexico. Their grandparents or their great-grandparents had been. But somehow it is programmed into these butterflies to fly to central Mexico, to the mountain area, and overwinter there, where about 100 million overwinter on about 20 acres of forest. That's 5 million butterflies per acre. It is an extremely fascinating thing to go there. The weight of the butterflies literally breaks the branches of the trees sometimes. As I became more and more attached to monarch butterflies, I did, again, a massive amount of research, read all the scientific articles and monograms and other books I could that were published about the monarch, and rewrote everything I read in sort of a layperson's terms. People who've read it really like it.
Your first novel was published 17 years ago, Remember Me Dancing. You told me it was a historical novel based on a real arranged marriage in your mother's generation. We've been visiting with Ken Perico, author of Across the Waters of Time. Plenty Remembered, a story about a historical figure from the first century. Where is the book available?
Probably the easiest way is through Amazon.com. I'm in process of putting up a web page called Plenty, P-L-I-N-Y, Remembered, one word, .com. I don't know that local bookstores have it yet, but certainly Amazon.com does. It just came out about a month ago.
Well, thanks so much for being with us. Best wishes on the success of the book.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Support for WPR comes from Ken Vance Honda, featuring the redesigned 2013 Honda Accord. Introducing HondaLink, a cloud-based system that connects to digital content without a mobile phone. More at kenvance.com. Support also comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making every business decision based on the premise of bringing customers back. More about Festival Foods' boomerang theory at festivalfoods.com.
Here's another Spectrum Memo, folks. Tomorrow at the Erica Quam Theater in Shell Lake, it's Shine, featuring a couple dozen of the best young talent in the Spooner and Shell Lake area. The fun gets underway at 7 p.m. Tickets at TITW, that stands for Theater in the Woods, .org. TITW.org. UW Eau Claire journalism grad Brianne Chasseau will talk Monday from noon to 1 p.m. on her experiences at NPR. National Public Radio. That will happen in the Hibbard Hall penthouse. Red Cedar, the annual journal of arts and literature at UW-Barron County, is soliciting submissions from creative writers, visual artists, and photographers for consideration in the 2013 edition. The deadline is Monday, February 25th. Contact Joel Friedrich at 234-8176, extension 5467. For details. It's called the 2013 Riverway Speaker Series. It's another amenity provided by the National Park Service and its active crew at the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway and the Visitor Center in St. Croix Falls. Next Saturday, the 16th, features the second in the series with three to follow. You'll hear historian and anthropologist Bruce White, also the author of two books on the history and interaction of the Ojibwe and Dakota people in the St. Croix Valley. Mr. White was kind enough to take time out of his busy schedule to share some dialogue about his life and its work, beginning with what led to a career in history and anthropology.
Well, my mother was a historian. She lived in Taylor's Falls for many years and worked on the history of the region. And, of course, that meant when I was 20 years old, that was the last thing I wanted to do. But I got hooked into it, and I'd been a French major in college because as a kid we had lived overseas and I'd learned French. And from that I got interested in the fur trade of the region, the St. Croix and Lake Superior, and gradually got interested in anthropology because it was a good way to learn more about Native people and their involvement in the fur trade. So I ended up getting a degree in history and then a degree in anthropology. So I try to combine the two, and anthropology gives you a sense of the cultural differences between people and when they interact, you know, Native people and fur traders and the French and the English. And so I try to bring that to studying the history of the region and how people got along with each other.
Yeah, and you know, I can't think of a broader field of study than that of anthropology. I mean, it's the science that deals with the origins, physical and cultural development, biological characteristics, and social customs and beliefs of humankind.
Yeah, there's physical anthropology, which deals with human remains, human body, the evolution of human beings, in fact. And there's archaeology, which is often considered to be a field of anthropology, which deals with village sites and also human remains. And then I'm more into the field of cultural anthropology, which deals with the cultural patterns, human societies. In the case of tribes, the differences between the Ojibwe or Chippewa and the Dakota or Sioux, who were in this region hundreds of years ago.
Your childhood with a connection to the St. Croix River, I'm guessing that that's part of where the fire started as well inside. Is that true?
Well, I think it certainly must have been. Well, as I said, my parents lived overseas before I was born, and I was born when they were living in Japan and then lived in the Philippines and France. And then my dad, who had been a forester with the Forest Service in St. Paul, he bought a piece of property north of Taylor's Falls, mostly woods. You know, other families bought lakefront property. My dad wanted woods because he was a forester. So I spent most of my summers there, 10 years old on, and an entire summer in an old farmhouse that had no running water or electricity within a mile of the St. Croix River. And we used to go on canoe trips. And, you know, then when I started reading about the fur trade, I discovered that there was this rich history of fur trade, the French coming into the region and trading with the Ojibwe and Dakota. And so I guess over the years, I've just understood how much richer it is as a place than when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, I just experienced the tangible aspects. I didn't know the history.
We're talking with Bruce White. He is an author. He's going to be a speaker at the Riverway Speaker Series presented by the National Park Service at the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway in St. Croix Falls. That's next Saturday.
Hope people come. It's at the Park Service Interpretive Center in St. Croix Falls.
Yeah, which is I keep hearing about that. I've never been over there, but that is a pretty neat place.
Yes, it's a nice place. I mean, the Park Service is doing a great job in helping to protect the St. Croix River.
Uh-huh. I found it interesting, Bruce, to note an explanation within the release that I received from the National Park Service where it mentioned the interaction of the Ojibwe and Dakota people in the St. Croix Valley found, quote, in the earliest written records of the French and in the oral traditions of both tribes, end of quote. Now, is it the word oral in that statement that made you decide that it was time to get more permanent documentation in place?
Well, I was working on my latest book that I've written with a number of other people. It's called Minnesota Makoche, The Land of the Dakota. Gwen Westerman and I are the authors. It was an attempt to look at the relationship of the Dakota people to the land of the region in which they lived. And, you know, 300 years ago, the Dakota were spread throughout most of the Minnesota region and into Wisconsin. So our attempt was to look at it from many different points of view. So oral history and written documents are just essentially two different ways of recording history. And, you know, from those sources, they reflect one another. It's not that the written documentation, you know, is necessarily needed to check the oral tradition. It's that sometimes the oral tradition is reflected in the written documentation.
Okay.
So when you look at it, much written documentation is merely oral history that was written down in the past. Somebody's statement about something that they heard from somebody.
Yeah. Well, that was my point. I wondered if someone thought it was a little bit too tenuous to just keep hoping that, you know, oral history was going to continue to be handed down, and it's probably important to get it written down.
Well, I guess you're right. It you know, it's nice when it is written down, but it's true that the Dakota have a rich oral tradition. Gwen Westerman found when she went out and interviewed people that there were many people with oral traditions or accounts that had never been interviewed before. You know, I think the purpose of the book is to try to make people aware that this region is a Dakota region. It was in the past. And this is the homeland of the Dakota, despite the fact that they were exiled from the region 150 years ago at the time of the 1862 war.
Is there a movement among Native Americans to work harder at preserving and protecting their heritage? Are young Native American people picking up the torch in that regard?
Well, especially in terms of language. Language revitalization is a very important point, and often the traditions are recorded in the language, so it's very important. There are language programs in various universities, and, you know, that's a really important thing. I mean, our book on the Dakota is really the first attempt to try to tell the relationship of the Dakota to the land in a way that people haven't understood. So far we've gotten a really positive reaction from Dakota people who say that it's about time this book was written. Well, I'm sure there are differences of opinion, but many of them find it to be a positive sign. My hope is that it will encourage more interest in doing the history.
So you must also feel a little bit of responsibility if they're pulling for you to get it all right, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, I kept saying during this project, once we get done, we'll figure out how to do it right. This book is several hundred pages, but it kind of touches the surface. You know, there's so much more to say, so much more to know. All the different places Dakota people knew and valued. I was going to mention one of the places that where you can see the connection between oral and written tradition on the St. Croix is a place called Catfish Bar. It's a sandbar south of Hudson and right across the river from Afton, Minnesota. It's a sandbar that stretches across the river, almost the entire width of the river, where the river makes a kind of bend. The scientific explanation is that's how the sandbar came into being, because of the bend in the river and the particulate matter in the river forms the sandbar. But the Dakota and Ojibwe have legends about how this place formed from a man who turned into a fish and then became a sandbar. It's part of their joint history that you were mentioning before.
Native American tribes had a lot of similarities to each other, but they were also pretty different and autonomous.
In the case of the Ojibwe and Dakota, they were allied, and they were also at war at different times. There was a lot of intermarriage between Ojibwe and Dakota people going back hundreds of years. And when the settlers first got here, they assumed that the Ojibwe and Dakota were, they used to say, implacable enemies. But their history tells otherwise. There's a clan among the Ojibwe that consists of people who are descended from the marriage of Dakota men and Ojibwe women, called the Mayingan, or Wolf Clan.
How do you pronounce the first part of that second book? It's kind of like Minnesota, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the origin of the word Minnesota, M-N-I-S-O-T-A, Minnesota.
Minnesota, and then the second word is Makoche?
Makoche, which means the land.
The Land of the Dakota, the first book, We Are at Home, Pictures of the Ojibwe People. So that's a couple books you've written. Any new offerings in the works?
I've worked for many years working on the fur trade, so I hope someday to finish my book on the fur trade of the region. I've got lots of plans. It's always a question of time.
Thanks so much for the work you do in preserving a very important history. That's good for everybody's future to have it.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Bruce White, interesting stuff. The presentation is next Saturday morning, February 16th, 10 a.m. at the St. Croix River Visitor Center. That's on North Hamilton Street in St. Croix Falls. Books and signings galore. Now, reservations are encouraged due to limited seating, and the phone number there is 715-483-2274. Hey, gang, I hope you had a good time today. I did. Next week, a Wisconsin Public Radio icon will be here, and I'll bet I'll convince a few others to make it, too. So I suggest you tune in to see how I do in that adventure. Thanks to Hillary Crusan for promotional support here on this week's Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Have a great weekend. See you next Friday.
Funding for On Point provided by Liberty Mutual Insurance for auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Drones, what...